Welcome back to Offworld, the show where we talk about all things space exploration and pop culture. I'm Ariel Waldman.
And I'm Norm Chan. And the movie we're going to be talking about this week, well, was released this year to not great fanfare, at least in the United States.
But it was absolutely huge in China. We're talking about The Wandering Earth. Came out in 2019. It's based off of the novella from 2000 by Cixin Liu, who also wrote The Three-Body Problem. And yeah, this was a really big deal of a movie in China and is now available on Netflix in the U.S.
Yes, free to stream. It's not only a big movie, it has big ideas. So the idea is the sun, the solar system, is no longer viable for the Earth. And so the population decides to then move the entire planet to a new solar system. A lot of questions we have about the science of this film, and we have a great guest this week to talk about those details. Let's take a listen.
Okay, so I'm really excited to have you on the show today, Serafina, because we're talking about The Wandering Earth, a film that came out this year in China. Say a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, so thanks for having me. I'm Serafina Nance. I am a graduate student at UC Berkeley in astrophysics. I mainly focus on supernova and cosmology with supernova.
Awesome. So, I mean, jumping right into it, Norm and I were really curious about, I mean, there's a lot of astrophysics in this movie, some more
yes.
believable than others, but like, we wanted to know, like, could you possibly move a planet if you wanted to? Could you move a planet and use Jupiter as a gravity assist the way that you do with spacecrafts?
Yeah. So I think it was a very interesting idea that they had to use, like, to move Earth instead of, like, put humans on a space shuttle and then just, like, send the space shuttle out. I was very curious to see why they chose that. I don't think it would be at all feasible to do the 10,000, like, rockets or shuttles on Earth to
those
propel
big
it.
Engines,
yeah,
right?
The engines.
Yeah, so there's 10,000 like huge engines on one side of the Earth. They've decided it's okay to essentially kill off half of all Earthlings.
Yeah.
Because they stopped spinning the Earth so that they could propel the Earth through space with all these 10,000 rockets on one side. So half of the Earth is completely dead and soaked in water,
right.
And the other half is frozen with rocket engines on them.
You don't want to live on that Earth.
So can we do that?
Yeah, so I think, like, there's a lot of problems with it. One of the problems is just getting the fuel for those engines. I think that you would, like, lose something like 95% of the mass of the Earth just to fuel those engines. And then the engines are, like, taller than Mount Everest, which is also, like, kind of not feasible. And then I think the fact that they would, like, be part of, like, what are they – like holding onto on the Earth itself, like I think they would likely just like fall back into the Earth. And then like the atmosphere of the Earth would likely be ripped off as you propel it through space. So interesting idea.
It's not like the Earth is just one big like basketball that's solid and you can
no.
have a hard surface that propel against. It's
yeah,
all
so,
these things.
Exactly. And I think, so I actually watched this film with like two other people in the astronomy department so we could all talk about the science of it. And one of the things that we talked about was like the magnetic field of the Earth. Would that be affected? And I don't think it would be a problem that the Earth stopped rotating for the magnetic field because magnetic field comes from the convection in the core.
Mm-hmm.
So that's still happening. It's just how that affects the like engines on the plate tectonics would be like a bigger issue.
Yeah. Well, so and the reason to back up a little bit, like the reason why in this film and based off of the novella from 2000, the reason why they're wanting to move Earth out of the solar system and using Jupiter as a gravity assist to go to another solar system 4.2 light years away is because this is a scenario in which the sun is now expanding at an extremely fast rate.
Very fast.
They say that the sun is going to engulf Earth in 100 years and the sun will engulf all of the solar system in 300 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of accelerating the timeline for when we know our sun might be expand. Well, our sun will be expanding at the end of its life, right? But is there ever a scenario in which the sun is going to be expanding that big, that fast?
Yeah, I hope not. I think so. The sun is definitely going to expand. But it has another like 5 billion years to be on the main sequence, meaning it's just like happily fusing hydrogen to helium, just kind of chilling. And then as it reaches, you know, the end of the main sequence, it's definitely going to expand, but it's not going to reach much farther than like we think it'll hit Earth, but I don't think it'll get much farther than that. So it will never get to the entire solar system, for one, and two, it'll take a long time for that to happen. Mm.
So even if this story was set a billion years in the future and somehow Earth technology gave us the ability to move the planet, the mass of the sun would still be the same. We just need to get out of that range of where it would expand to where we are.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So there are, to go back to your first question, there are some ideas of like moving, potentially moving a planet if we did decide to go that route. So you could use like a light sail, which is using the light from the sun to as an energy source to like move the Earth. I think I read somewhere that you could like somehow use like ballistics of meteors. So like if we like somehow hit a meteorite and it'll push the Earth away. But again, that's on the scale of like millions of years.
Yeah, well, and something I know some people were concerned about is like, what happens with the moon? Does it go crashing into the Earth?
Great question. Yeah, I think that would be an issue, definitely. And then you'd have issues with tidal forces, which they did kind of discuss a little bit in terms of like, I think there was a bunch of like floods and hurricanes. And
yeah,
and
well, I think they were implying that half of Earth's population just drowned. And that was that.
Great.
Yeah, a scenario in which you're okay with killing off half of the Earth in order to save all of Earth.
Right.
Or attempt to. And yeah, no, there's so many things. And then they depict in the movie people living underground as a way of protecting them from the expanding sun. And I guess, you know, the constant winter on one side.
Yeah. So that's an interesting idea because the expanding sun is definitely, I mean, you're going to have insanely hot temperatures. You're going to have radiation in all sorts of forms. I mean, we have like solar flares and we have, you know, weather on the sun that already affects the Earth, like technology and stuff like that. So I think it's definitely interesting to kind of burrow into the Earth and see what happens. I don't know if 5 kilometers is enough. But that being said, like, I guess that's definitely a way to kind of solve that problem.
And what are the more kind of smaller scale problems? Like we're not talking about the scenario in which the sun is gone or expanding and the solar system is completely uninhabitable, but you're talking about solar flares.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on a smaller scale problem, if there were higher activity of solar flares, what would be a practical thing to do?
So I think, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind with any sort of weather on the sun is how it affects, like our normal day-to-day life. So all, like if there's a like large weather on the sun, like a big storm or whatever, like a big solar flare, we've had rolling blackouts. We've had aircraft that like can't land, or you know, things like that. Which I guess in this sort of future world, I don't even know if those sorts of things exist. But it definitely changes, I guess, like your day to day life, and that's completely different from the radiation that you experience, or sort of the like completely unlivable temperatures. This like surface of the Earth boiling away.
Yeah, I mean, so we've touched on a few different elements. I wanted to know, you know, as an astrophysicist, like what elements were kind of delightful for you to contemplate or think about? Like what did it illuminate where you're like, that's kind of cool, you know?
Yeah, I think the thing that I was really excited about was, using Jupiter as a slingshot. That was really cool. I mean, we already do that with spacecraft. And so to think about using it for a planet is awesome. I think I really, really enjoyed like the diagrams that they showed of the Roche limit nearing Jupiter and sort of how the trajectory changes. I thought that was really interesting. And I mean, the vista of the sun sort of standing, looking at Jupiter was incredible. Like, that reminded me of, like, scenes from, I don't know, some of the best sci-fi movies that I've ever seen. So that was really, really beautiful. Scientifically, I think one of the best things they did was the Roche limit. That was awesome to kind of see that in play.
Can you explain that? Yeah, totally.
So when you have two bodies in space, they can interact with each other depending on the masses and the distance between them. And so when you get close enough, one of those bodies can actually accrete mass from the other. So in this movie, Jupiter was accreting mass from the Earth in the form of, I guess, like the Earth's atmosphere. And, you know, I guess at some point, if they weren't able to do anything, the Earth would completely be stripped away. So there is a point in space where that happens. And that, again, is dependent on the distance and the mass. So that was really, really cool to see. It happens with supernova. It happens with sort of any bodies that are orbiting and accreting on each other.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the beautiful things I thought in the movie was seeing the dad who's on this version of the International Space Station and is drawing, like, Jupiter getting larger and larger in his window and sort of seeing it out the window, which is really cool. But importantly, like, in the film, they bring up the Roche limit because, Earth's atmosphere is starting to get stripped away from Jupiter because they've pushed Earth too close to Jupiter by accident last minute. They just realize they're off by a few degrees.
That was definitely
the last minute. And then the solution they have is to ignite the hydrogen in Jupiter to act as a propellant force.
I was inspired. Yeah.
Norma, did you think of that?
I mean, I think that what really helped show was like this scope of not only how far things are away from each other in the solar system, but how big things are, like how big Jupiter is relative to Earth. We don't really think about that in our scale models. But when you can portray an idea like slingshotting around Jupiter, it makes you think, wow, Jupiter is really a lot more bigger than Earth. And that's how you could portray this.
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of questions of like, if you ignite Jupiter, do you ignite all of Jupiter?
Yeah.
Like, do you get to really have a controlled burn? I mean, I assume you don't have a very controlled burn, but it's like, if you ignite part of Jupiter, does it just like, is it a dud and it's just you've ignited part of it, or is it all of it?
And the rate at which it ignites, actually come up like that? And it's... That was very convenient.
I think one of the things that I realized was, like, things slam into Jupiter's atmosphere all the time, and none of those ignite. Mm-hmm. So I think that is one of the questions. It's like, what is it about this that actually makes it happen? And the other thing is, like, okay, if this happened, I'm pretty sure that, like, you would destroy, like, a large portion of the Earth just from the shockwave of the explosion.
Right, right. And all they had was that countdown at the end of the film,
and
bracing the elevator.
Yeah.
And they showed a fair amount of destruction, but then the engines were fine working.
Yeah, exactly. Still going.
Yeah, right. They could light them up right after they cleared.
Yeah, well, and we saw a similar sort of like explosion logic in a recent film, Ad Astra, which exploded, I think, the spacecraft to propel another spacecraft. But again, just an uncontrolled explosion will get you in the right direction. It's a lot of people have, you know, I guess wishful thinking for explosions and using rockets and everything. Let's talk a little bit about the aesthetics of the movie, though. Like, just like the look and feel of like the spacesuits and the spaceships, and you know, were there any aesthetics that you particularly appreciated?
Definitely, I thought it was an absolutely beautiful movie. I loved the depiction of the Earth with the blue engines on one side and the smoke kind of trailing out. I thought that was stunning. I thought, again, like the depiction of Jupiter was gorgeous. I saw like a scale picture of the Earth next to just part of Jupiter, just kind of separately. And it was smaller than the red spot on Jupiter. So, I mean, that kind of gives you a sense of like what they're looking up at and just how close they are. So I thought that was gorgeous. I loved the sort of callback to gravity and that sort of like the Russian cosmonaut and the dad were kind of falling through space and along the space station. That was awesome. And then the callback to 2001 with Hal and Moss, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
That was really cool. I loved the like, oh, we'll just throw some alcohol on it and burn it all up. Like that works. So yeah, I thought that was all very cool and like a nice testament to some of the like really incredible space movies and sci-fi movies that have sort of paved the way to like new age space movies. Yeah, I thought it was gorgeous.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, I liked seeing, you know, elements of like the ice that's built up to the tallest, skyscraper in Shanghai.
Cool.
I've been at the top of that skyscraper. So it was
good,
like visual for me to like, be like, wait, that's pretty tall ice built up, over all of Shanghai. And I think that was probably a lot of the fun, I think, for this movie release, you know, which did hugely successful in China, like getting to actually see, you know, Chinese architecture in a movie like this.
Absolutely.
Which like is in, you know, most Western movies not shown. So that was really cool. The aesthetics I thought were interesting because for me, it was interesting to look at like what aesthetics were clearly more of a Chinese aesthetic versus what aesthetics were more of like a typical Western culture thing. So there were some spacesuits that felt very referential to things like gravity, and the very typical like American spacesuits. But there were other ones that seemed much more in line with what Chinese nationals wear who are preparing for spaceflight.
Definitely.
Norm, did you have any?
Yeah, I mean, it almost felt like they had, I mean, the production was on an unimaginable scale, right? And they had to not only have the depiction of what this life would be like on the space station and all the technology there with the Moss robot, but also what life would be like on this new Earth where people have to live underground and have these exosuits and have these pressure suits and heat suits. And all of that was, I think, really beautifully depicted. I love your point about, you know, the enjoying the view of that Earth flying through space, because it's a little bit of that pale blue dot moment.
Absolutely.
Where, you know, they could have done a story where it was just a ship with X number of thousands of survivors. But when you have the entirety of the surviving human population traveling through space where it is tiny compared to even another planet, it does have this little unifying, you know, visual. And I think the movie is kind of optimistic that way, right? Even though it is a disaster movie and it's about like the worst possible scenario where all life has no very, very small chance of surviving. The optimism is how like it is a space station where they have the technology for hibernation to work and things do work. Like that was knowing how space programs and how slow, right, that stuff works today in the real world is really cool to see. Okay, if humanity came together, could we build a space station with this kind of clockwork-like operation that would just work?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of like long duration views throughout the whole movie. You know, I mean, it goes into the whole, I mean, back again to the fact that they've sacrificed half of Earth's population.
We can't move away from that.
Like, yeah, well, I can't move away from that because they're just kind of like, oh yeah, by the way, half of the Earth died, so that
was
we could
very
just,
practical,
and then
right?
we move yeah. on from that.
And
we don't talk about it for the rest of the film.
The most recent disaster, 1.5 million workers sacrificed their lives to get these engines back up and running, and they just said it very matter-of-factly.
Yeah.
Because
yes.
everyone has that is working together for that purpose,
right.
Not for themselves, but for like generations down the line, 2,500 years
totally.
For a new home.
Yeah, well, and I think the idea was that it's going to take around 2,000 years or something for them to get to this next star system, but they're all going to have to live underground in the meantime. And so there's a lot of like, well, you know, we're in this for the long haul, for 2,000 years of generations. And I don't know. I certainly had questions of, you know, well, if you can survive that long without a son, do you really need a son at that
Absolutely.
Point?
Absolutely. Like, I was just thinking about that. Like, okay, I guess the idea to be able to move the Earth to a new sun is, well, the Earth is unique and we want to preserve that. But at what point does that uniqueness kind of become moot because it's so exposed to outer space and the elements that, like, we just have no idea of when we're just kind of chilling by our sun? And does that – is that irrevocable change once you get to Proxima Centauri? Yeah, I think that's a very interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, well, and another long-duration thing depicted in the movie is the space station, unbeknownst to the astronauts, has, like, 300,000 human embryos on board, like, archives of civilization. You know, this is definitely spoiler, but we're spoiling the whole movie, so it's okay. So the idea is that the space station goes into, like, emergency mode, realizing that Earth is about to be destroyed. And it's like, it's cool, everyone. We'll just send the astronauts on their way with the embryos and the archives. And the astronauts decide that's not good enough since, you know, there'll be hardly anyone alive. Just some eggs and some books.
Yeah, I think it was a very interesting, I guess, twist in the end when the dad decided to sacrifice himself. At what point, and I mean, I think anyone can discuss this for a long time, is at what point are those sacrifices, like, do you, like, defeat the point of actually, like, doing it? I don't know.
It's kind of a selfish move, right? Because even, like, all the people on Earth had resigned themselves.
Exactly.
To, like, the failed mission of the wandering Earth. And if their whole point was to somehow ensure the survival of the human species, it really did feel like what the robot, what Moss had planned in the Helios project, right, that backup, was probably had a better chance of survival and success than crashing it. Right. But it was a gamble. It was the human connection. That's the,
it's always the love.
The father-son relationship.
I thought it was interesting. I really enjoyed the idea of a united Earth government, like, just to think about. I thought that was a very interesting thing. I also thought it was interesting that, I mean, really the three civilizations that we know were still there, Chinese, American, and Russian. And kind
they
of what
so
that,
show some French.
Yeah, I guess there is some French like overtones. Yeah, but I thought that was just a very interesting future that they chose to kind of explore.
Yeah, I mean it's fair because so many films from the U.S. are like just about the same level of inclusivity of like, there's a couple other nations, but we've forgotten entire continents. That's okay. Yep. So getting into the sort of final question here, you know, where do you feel like this movie fits in a portfolio of space movies? Like, there are a lot of referential things of, you know, Gravity and Day After Tomorrow. Like, what do you think this movie adds to the current portfolio of space movies that maybe we don't see elsewhere?
Yeah, I think it was very unique. Like, no one has ever explored the idea of let's move a planet and talk about it through a film or a book. So I thought that it's a sweeping space epic that is a unique niche that is beautiful, it's engaging, and I think it absolutely has a place amongst sort of these other films that I've watched, you know, 10, 20 times throughout my life. I personally, like, I think I would rather watch this than Interstellar, like, from a personal standpoint. So I think it absolutely has the same, like, gravity as some of these other films that, you know, in the U.S. everybody knows and has seen a couple of times in films. I mean, there were several times during that movie, I think the first opening sequence, I was like, man, really wish I was watching this in IMAX. Whereas in Interstellar, like, I watched it 3 times at IMAX. What do you guys think?
Well, I was, you know, thinking also there's the fact that you deal with an expanding sun as a central point. So I actually had a final question for you, which was like, what sort of like sci-fi would you like to see that involves either stars or supernovas or suns that like haven't seen? Like, are there cool elements to supernovas or other things that you'd like to see sort of play out as a science fiction?
Yeah, I think it is interesting sort of as technology progresses and we're making more sci-fi films And I think absolutely over the past, I don't know, even 50 years, we've been focused on the moon and Mars and our solar system. And to expand that to say, okay, we can now actually talk about black holes, and we can talk about supernova, and we can talk about an almost post-apocalyptic thing with the sun expanding, and talk about other aspects of astronomy through film. And we now have the resources to do that. I mean, even 2001 A Space Odyssey had the resources to do that years ago, and did a fantastic job with that. So I think really portraying some of these incredibly cool, visually incredible things through film would be incredible. And I really hope that happens.
Yeah, and some of these stories can only be told in the long view.
Yeah.
Because space, and you know, happens at a pace that's not human scale.
Absolutely.
Right? It's civilization scale, if that, right? It's so, and while this movie was just a slice of that 15 years or so, everyone talks about it as if it's a given. Generations down the line, you know, slowing the planet down once it finds a new solar system. And you can, I don't know if this movie could have been made 5 years ago or 10 years ago, or even for an American audience, because right. Like we love here, we love, you know, stories that are definitely more personal and that we can relate to. And it's kind of very nihilistic to think about stories that go way beyond our concept of time and space.
I think that's such a good point. I think especially American films really like a hero, mm-hmm. and having a multi-generational film is really the only way to tell a space story that is, I guess, like does grace to the vastness of space. And so doing that in a really beautiful way is a feat. I mean, it's incredible.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
So I really enjoyed that conversation, especially towards the end. We were talking about generational things and this long-term view, and how this movie, more so than some others, really illuminated that sort of thinking that you need when it comes to space exploration in general.
Yeah, I mean, that is what I think separates this movie from a lot of the big space disaster films we've seen. Armageddon, Deep Impact, even Interstellar. Yeah, those are all about the Earth in peril, but those are about the, you know, the singular group of American heroes that are going to save the day. And this was really about an entire planet coming together in a way that we've never really seen before portrayed in film. And that probably was the biggest leap, right? Science aside, the biggest leap that the Earth could come together. And I really like that part.
Yeah, I appreciated it. I was trying to think of other films and places where we've seen generational thinking, and certainly Passengers brings that mm-hmm. to light, but in a creepier way. Yeah. Like, this is an interesting thing to think about, a generational ship, but it's not a ship, it's the entire Earth. Right. So you get to have at least some of the nice parts of staying at home, even though you're 5 kilometers underground.
It makes me really curious about what audiences in the States think about this type of movie. Because it seems very futile. There is no singular hero or heroes that make it right at the end, because the end is thousands of years in the future. There's a book, Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson, which also has similar generational thinking, or, you know, with a big disaster. And people have been wanting to make that film for a long time. And again, I'm curious, would the American audience like it? Is that the reason this wasn't put in theaters?
Yeah, well, so if whether or not you're in America, if you're watching this or listening to this, please leave a comment and let us know your thoughts, because we're really curious like where this movie lands with audiences outside of China.
And if you are listening to the podcast, or you want to listen to the podcast, you can always subscribe to us at tested.com/offworld. We'll be back soon with another episode talking about another space movie. But until then, we'll see you.